And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Mark Greeney back to the program today. Mark is probably best known to readers around the country for co-authoring three Jack Ryan novels with Tom Clancy, and then writing three more Ryan books after Mr. Clancy passed away. But Book Talk listeners first heard of Mark when the first book in his Gray Man series was published in 2009, and he made his debut on our program. And today we'll be talking about book number 5, entitled Backblast. Now, it's the first one that's in hardcover. Why did they finally decide to move Court Gentry up to the big leagues?
I don't know. From the beginning, when I got my first book deal, obviously you're just thrilled to have a book deal. But my agent from the very beginning said he'd seen authors come out hardback too soon and it ended up hurting their careers. So he said, don't worry about it, that your paperback. I went from mass market paperback, which is the small
that you find in the grocery store,
that you find in the grocery stores or pharmacies or whatever, up into the nicer trade paperback. And now I finally made it into hardback. My books are published in several languages. And the actual first hardback that I've ever seen of my writing was The Gray Man in Italian, which came out last year. And so it was not even in English. I can't read it. But there is an existing hardback. But this is my first U.S. hardback.
What's the name of the Gray Man series in Italy?
Oh, my gosh. Tre giorni per un delitto. You thought I wouldn't know that. And I probably, no one who speaks Italian will know what that means.
And so what does it mean?
It means 3 days for a crime, I think. Someone told me that.
So it's been more than 3 days since Court Gentry has been burned by the CIA. What's been keeping Court Gentry outside of the United States for so long?
I write all my books as standalone novels. So if you pick up book 4 as your first book or book 2, you immediately get into the story because I think it's important. You know, as authors, we're lucky if people pick up our books at all. But there's always been this thread going through the series, you know, a longer story arc that transcends one book. And the thing that's been going on with this character, he's a CIA, ex-CIA hitman who's been on the run from the CIA for 5 years doing jobs, killing people that he feels warrant the death. And he has never really known why it was the CIA was after him. And he's tried to find answers throughout the books in small ways. But now here we are in book 5, and I've teased it long enough, and it was just time to go big with that story arc and bring him back to the United States. As I said, the CIA is trying to kill him, and he's come back to the D.C. area to figure out why.
When he was working for the CIA, he was known as a door kicker.
Yeah.
Part of the Goon Squad.
Right.
Golf Sierra was the name of his outfit. And he had his morals kind of taken care of for him. He just followed orders and he did what he was told to do, assumed it was for the best interest of the United States. But since he's been burned out of the CIA, he developed his own moral code. And so, as you said, he would kill those who he would think they were bad.
Yeah. He would work for a bad guy as long as that bad guy was asking him to terminate some other villain out there in the world, some other actor that he felt warranted it. So he had no moral code about who he would work for. It was all just a means to the end. And he was working for money, and he was working to ultimately dig his way through this maze, this wall of mirrors, and figure out what this whole thing was hanging over his head. As you said, when he worked for Special Activities Division in the CIA, he was one guy on a team, and he did not question his jobs or whatever. But now he questions what he does, and he makes his own decisions. And there's been several times in the series where people who knew him, you know, historically before the series started, you know, would express surprise that he was a thinking man himself. But I think it's interesting to kind of explore the moral code of people who do this sort of thing. You know, even military, even law enforcement, you have to have this ability to flip a switch and say, this person in front of me, I've made the decision that this person is some sort of a threat. You know, in the bigger world, Court Gentry, the Gray Man, has gone out and targeted these people.
And I think his biggest moral quandary probably came in the second book in the series that was set in Africa, in which he either had to kill a man or let him live, and there was no good result coming from either one of those actions.
Right. I like these quandaries when I read them in books. There's a great Frederick Forsyth book called The Devil's Alternative. I think it came out in about 1980, early 80s or something. And I remember reading that book, not at the when it came out, but later on, and just being blown away by this. There's really no good option. Let's pick the less bad option out there. Yeah, that my second book, On Target, he was tasked with terminating a man, but he decided that if he could kidnap him and bring him to the International Criminal Court, it would end up doing more good but it also violated his orders that he had from everybody that he was subservient to. So it led him on a long trail. But I like these types of questions about just having to decide for yourself what the right move is.
Now, in the fourth book, he committed a moral good overall and helped save someone's life. And that made another intelligence agency, the Mossad, at least one of their actors, feel somewhat good to him for a little bit. And they helped him get back to America.
Yes.
That was this one actor.
That's right. He has developed confederates along the way. And sometimes it's conditional and sometimes you see them in later books. But he was in Europe in book four. And he was looking for a way back into the United States. But when everyone in the intelligence community is after you and people in the military are after you and you're on the 10 most wanted list, or you're on the most wanted list.
Number 19, I
yeah,
think.
Exactly. I'm glad you remember the number. Then it's a little tough to just go through customs. It should be. But the work he did for this one part of the Mossad, one man felt like he really owed court something. And he asked him what it was that he wanted, you know, most of all in the world. And he wanted to get out of where he was and into somewhere else. And that's brought him to this book.
And so he's back in America. And especially in the last book, we saw how much facial recognition software and surveillance cameras around Europe and now around America kind of changed the way operators have to operate.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges court faces in that?
It gets a lot more complicated for people writing these cloak and dagger books because right now there's so many cameras looking at you and the facial recognition technology has improved and improved and improved. So other than reasserting in every chapter that your character has a hat on or sunglasses or something like that, there's a little bit of a conceit that he has the ability to spoof these through physical things he does, through recognition of locations that he's in. And I tried to play it accurately without taking away from the story, because you could write a whole 160,000-word novel about a guy trying to walk across Washington, D.C. without getting his picture taken. But I don't think anyone would want to read it. So there's significant portions of the story which involve how he's able to travel as the gray man, as this sort of invisible entity, this ghost, through this city. And I played it based on what I know about facial recognition and some educated guesses and some wild guesses, and just to make it a fun story. But, you know, I don't have the technical knowledge or interest to make that the story itself.
And at least in this case, he goes to the poorer parts of town where there's fewer national chains. Mm-hmm. And so the security is pretty much up to the mom and pop stores.
Right.
And they're not going to have the resources behind them that the bigger companies do.
Yeah, he just wants to go in and get something to eat at one point, and he has to go to five or six different convenience stores to find one where they don't have a camera shining on the front entrance where they can see his car. He's less interested with them seeing him come in and go because he never plans on being there again, but he doesn't want them to see what kind of vehicle he's in. So there's lots of little tradecraft things like that, that as this series, I'm on book five now. When I wrote the first book, I knew very little. I had very few contacts in the intelligence community or in the military. And as I've learned more and more about these different things, I've wanted to incorporate them in the book as long as it adds to the story.
And that's the difference between the Gray Man series and the Jack Ryan books, is that in the Jack Ryan books, you're dealing with these huge weapon system technologies, right, and you're dealing with smaller bits of more personal technology in the Gray Man series.
Right. There is a real macro in the Clancy books and a micro in the Gray Man books, where you're looking over the shoulder of Court Gentry as he tries to achieve his objectives. You also are in the point of view of several other characters, good guys and bad guys, and then there's a lot of media involved in this one. Anytime rolling gun battles are going on in Washington, D.C., that's going to make it on CNN. So I have a lot of asides, a lot of stuff going on in the media. But I thought that keeping it at a ground-level story, more or less, at least as compared to the Tom Clancy books, is the right way to go to differentiate between the two series.
With Court's moral sense, he needs money and he needs weapons, but he doesn't want to go out and rob someone who's a law-abiding citizen for the most part. So how does he go about acquiring these things?
The book opens with him in Southeast Washington, D.C., which is one of the most dangerous places in America as far as one of the highest crime areas of America, in a Ward 8, which at the time I wrote the book about a year ago, I think was number 2 or something like that. And he basically goes to a drug stash house. So I met with narcotics officers here in Memphis, and other police officers talked about what people say, how they defend these drug stash houses and how meth is transported and all this other stuff. The book has nothing to do with drug dealing. Gentry has just arrived in America. He basically has the clothes on his back and he wants a bunch of money and he wants some weapons and he likes going after bad guys. So that put him at a drug house within a couple hours of him getting off of a boat.
But how likely is the Aryan Brotherhood to have a shop set up in D.C.?
This is a great question that you asked that I wish you didn't ask, but it's a great question that you asked. And if anyone would ask it, it would be you. As I was writing the book and I was looking at the crime there, I didn't want this to turn into a urban warfare. He's in bad parts of Washington, D.C., and demographically, they would be different than bad parts in other places or whatever. But I wanted to spread the violence around. Yes, there are white supremacists in the D.C. area. I don't know that they're in Ward 8, but these guys are because they're so incredibly bad and they're so incredibly well-fortified and well-armed. Is it an actual thing? Probably not. But when I wrote that in there, I was like, I wonder how long before somebody points this out. And here I am on my first interview. But a lot of times, this is my first interview with you. And a lot of times, you're the only one that brings something up. So I think I'm probably okay.
I'm sorry to be a pain in the neck like that.
It's depth. It's great. It's great.
Yeah. In that one drug stronghouse, the booby traps they had set up, especially the fish hooks, was just terrifying.
And I have a buddy who's a tactical officer in DeSoto County here near Memphis, and he's also on the narcotics team. And he was running down a list of things that they do that they see at these dash houses. And when he said that, I was like, say that again? You know, as an author, you get excited by it, but it's a pretty horrible thing, yeah.
So also, he needs a place to stay. And he's chosen to go with renting a room. Why do you think he's done this instead of just setting up in an empty warehouse or something like that, putting these other people at risk?
He is putting other people at risk, but the way that I've written him over the five books, I wanted him to operate here in the States much as he's operated when he's been in Europe, when he's been in Central America, when he's been in Africa, and he's gone to guest houses. He's very much not James Bond. He's looking for the low rent places he can find that are trouble spots, and he's able to sort of melt within the fabric of it. And I think he has a pretty good cover story when he just rents from a private individual. He gets around. There's no background check.
But as the gray man, he's supposed to not stand out. And being the only white man in an African-American neighborhood,
yeah,
he kind of stands out.
He's got a good story, though, as to why he's there. I mean, I think his explanation as to why he'd be there is fair. I could have put him in this really gentrified Old Town Alexandria or you know, Crystal City or something like that. But it just felt right because I wanted the grit of D.C. and I wanted you to feel that he's in the fabric of this location just as he would be in other places. So when he's in the Middle East, he probably stands out as a white man, but he still has this ability to blend in. And even when he's in Guatemala or something like that, he's 5'11", and he stands out to a degree. So it's less about him being the only white guy in this neighborhood, which I think it was predominantly Hispanic and African-American. It's his story that gets him in there and his ability to sort of move in the shadows. He's mostly moving around at night and that sort of thing.
And to put a little leverage of his own when he notices that the space isn't up to code.
Right. The guy who's renting the place out has built a little tiny little basement himself. And the gray man has looked at the lay of the land from a tactical standpoint and says, this little dump right here is perfect for my needs. But he's not about to, hand over identification, which he doesn't have, and get a background check or anything like that. So he's able to sort of finagle his way once he starts seeing all the code violations that this home handyman has built a little basement apartment has created.
Now, the CIA does get word that Gentry is coming, but they get a little too late.
Yes, they get it shortly after he arrives. They find out from Israel that he is on his way or his arrival is imminent. But they start out one step behind, but there's a whole lot more guys looking for the gray man than there are the gray man. There's an entire working group at the CIA, a whole bureaucracy that's been after him for years, and they're able to call up military assets and do all these other things. And once the head of the National Clandestine Service of the CIA, the main guy who's been after Court all these years, once he realizes Court is in his area of operations, he just pulls out all the stops and amasses everything.
Now, we're always told that the CIA is not supposed to operate on American soil. Wink, wink.
Yes. And, you know, there's all sorts of laws that say what they can and cannot do. And in this book, a lot of those are thrown out the window.
That's the kind of guy Denny Carmichael is.
Yes. Denny Carmichael, who's the villain, and he's also the head of the National Clandestine Service. He has pulled out all the stops and broken rules for several of these five books now, or the previous four books. And now you'll see what he's willing to do as the situation gets more and more desperate. And he sees this cherry ripe for picking, that the gray man is right here in his area. And a lot of people warn him early in the book, if the gray man's here, he's probably coming after you. And we think you should hunker down. And he says, this is an opportunity. I'm a hunter. I'm not going to just wait him out. So he pulls out all the stops to go after him.
Now, you have made a lot of contacts and probably some friends in the intelligence community over the span of writing these books and the Jack Ryan books. But here you have who is ostensibly the bad guy, the head of National Clandestine Services. Do you feel any kind of conflict in that you probably support the aims of American intelligence, but showing their leader as corrupt and not acting in the country's best interest? Do you feel any conflict in yourself about that?
That's a great question. I don't, because I probably felt it more when it was still very vague, where it looked like the CIA was out just trying to kill a rogue agent. And then if you've stayed with the series, or if you just pick this one up, you'll know by page 25 that here's this rogue ex-CIA agent who's back in the country and everyone is worried about him. You learn pretty quickly in this book that it's one guy against Gentry for some reason. You don't know if it's a legitimate reason or not, but you see a lot of people pretty high up in the agency, you know, explaining that they're not part of this. And Denny Carmichael has this little fiefdom in the CIA. So I could never...
There's a lot of CYA in the CIA.
Exactly. And you know, it adds tension to your novel and if there's a lot of tension between the different characters. So you'll be in a seventh floor boardroom meeting with CIA people and there's all sorts of nuances of, as you say, CYA and other tension between the different characters. But as you said, this absolutely isn't something I could do in a Jack Ryan novel. Jack Ryan novels are a lot more white hat and black hat as far as the American establishment. This book has, you know, a guy without the moral compass that Gentry has running the CIA. And he firmly believes it's the right thing to do, what he's doing. So I just like the gray areas. And I like when my villains, you know, truly believe in what they're doing. And if they're running the CIA or if they're president of the United States, which could happen in a subsequent book, you know, it's human nature. There's good and bad everywhere.
And Denny Carmichael has a very cozy working relationship with the head of Saudi intelligence in America. And so he's asked him to send a hit squad after Gentry as well. So here you have the head of the CIA, essentially, not the political head, but the actionable head, sending off foreign agents to kill an American on American soil.
Yeah, but you have to look at the reasons that those guys are on American soil. And from Denny Carmichael's view, as you get deeper and deeper into the book, you see that he's worked out a pretty, as you say, a cozy deal, but a pretty beneficial deal to the United States. What he thinks the Saudis are doing here in America and what he's doing with his operatives and the intelligence that he's getting from Saudis in exchange. He admits to himself that it's a wholly illegal relationship that he has with the head of Saudi intelligence, but he can run down a list of benefits that he feels the United States has gotten over the years from this relationship and what he feels is a very small price to pay. Now, once Court Gentry arrives in Washington, D.C., Denny Carmichael, as I say, pulls out all the stops and he brings in Delta Force people. He brings in, contracted hitmen. And he brings in these Saudis, which he knows are operating here in what he thinks is a non-direct action.
And he even brings a man back from the dead.
He does. He brings a man back who disappeared years earlier. And most people in the CIA think he's dead. His name is Zach Hightower. And he was a big part of one of the earlier books. Just from all the emails I've gotten from fans over the past 6 or 7 years that this series is in effect, I haven't gotten more emails on any other subject other than Zach Hightower. Bring Zach back. Bring Zach back. He never died. I never intended for him to be dead. I thought he'd show up at some point. But as I was sort of plotting this book out, I thought, well, what fun would it be if Zach Hightower, who has his own contentious relationship with Court Gentry, if Hightower came back as a rogue operative in D.C. to hunt the gray man?
And he has an incredibly elastic moral sense as well.
Yes. Boy, if it exists at all, right? He's a worker bee, and he's told what to do. And it's not until late in the book he starts asking his own questions. He does say pretty early on, hey, you know, Gentry thinks he's the good guy and we're the bad guys. And honestly, I'll put the guy in the dirt because that's my job. But, you know, I'm not analyzing this situation. I'm here to do a job.
We see Zach, first off, he is being a hunting guide. It was in West Virginia near Greenbrier.
Right.
And, of course, I was thinking it's going to be at the bunker, the Greenbrier bunker.
Yeah, no, it could have gone there. Wow, yeah.
But he was taking a group of college kids out, and one of them had a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle bourbon with them, but they were also drinking Natural Light. And I just kind of thought that was a weird combination of Natural Light plus this extremely expensive bourbon.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, they're rich guys, but I just thought it would – I'm just thinking college kids. I don't know that there was a whole lot that went into that thought. I was thinking college, but I was also thinking, you know, they come in on one of their father's jets or whatever. So I was just looking at these guys, people that Zach would really not like. And
super entitled. And
yeah, exactly, exactly.
Because of Denny Carmichael's top-down style of management, he includes as few people in the loop as possible, but he has to bring someone in to lead the Tactical Operations Center. Why does he choose Suzanne Brewer?
Suzanne Brewer is a new character. She hasn't been in any of the other books, and she is from the Programs and Plans Division of the CIA. The recent part of her career with CIA has been fortifying CIA installations to defend against outside attacks or lone wolf attacks. She's been based in Yemen and she's been based in Afghanistan. And now she's back in the United States and has been red selling. So she's been creating these sort of testing CIA installations in the United States to make sure they're safe from physical attack. So when the gray man shows back up and everybody is very concerned that he's going to do some sort of an attack against the CIA, the truth is he's there to find answers. It's more of a mystery to Gentry than some sort of a, you know, one-man assault on the CIA. But they bring Suzanne Brewer in because she's the expert on keeping CIA assets safe.
A few years ago, I remember you told me a story of when your iPhone was stolen when you were in D.C. doing research, and there was a scene where Gentry was running around D.C. at night. Did you have flashbacks while you were writing that scene?
Both scenes took place very near DuPont Circle, so it's funny you should say that. My iPhone was stolen around 11 a.m., and I chased the guy on foot for a while, or two guys. Actually got the phone back because a triathlete happened to be coming by on a 10-speed, and he chased after him until they just got tired of running, and they handed the phone off to a jogger. But I chased them several blocks. I remember calling my girlfriend at the time and saying I just chased this guy like half a mile, and then when I looked at it on Google later, it was like 400 yards or if that.
Well, that's a quarter mile.
Yeah, and I couldn't go up or down a flight of stairs the next day because of, you know, I was so sore. But I spent about a month in D.C. researching this Gray Man book. I was there this time last year. So I walked all the different locations and did a lot of physical reconnaissance. So all that happens in DuPont Circle and these chases through D.C., it was right in that area, that same area.
It must be extremely exhausting to constantly be doing this political calculus you have to do when you're in a governmental organization trying to get ahead. And Suzanne Brewer must have an insane level of calculation going on constantly, just seeing which way the wind's blowing at any given moment.
Yeah, the infighting that I've created in the CIA in this book, I'm sure some of my friends in CIA or ex-CIA will read it and scratch their heads and say, wow, it was not, you know, we were all pretty much on the same team. But, you know, I've worked in large corporations. There is this, as you say, this calculus of which fiefdom that you want to be involved with and who's on the way up and who's on the way down. And there are people that are several rungs above the ladder in the CIA executive leadership who see Suzanne Brewer and immediately identify her as a high flyer in the agency, and she's shooting to the top. So people even above her are trying to get in her good graces. She picks a winner early on and thinks she's going to stick with it. But as she starts to learn more, she's a character that I spent a lot of time developing because I didn't want her to be this two-dimensional person. And you see her change throughout the story. But as you say, as the wind blows, she's a high flyer in the agency, and suddenly she's found herself more or less running this operation that looks like just a big mess to everybody. And she's trying to save herself physically, and she's trying to save her career at the same time. So there's a lot going on in her head throughout this book.
And also because of Denny Carmichael's top down, he's chosen to keep out Quart's former SAD overseer, Matthew Hanley, out of the loop. Why has he kept Hanley out of this?
Carmichael doesn't trust him because he thinks Hanley's after his job. There's a joke in there that, you know, when he says that, you know, other people in the room chime in that they're after Carmichael's job as well because he's running the show. But Carmichael and Hanley have a very contentious relationship with one another. And as you look into the Matthew Hanley character, you see him as a good guy because he's been in the series in earlier books before and has always come out as more good than bad. But in the Gray Man series, that's a very relative term. But he's a guy that's also trying to leverage his positions and his power. You have to question whether he has Gentry's interests in mind or if he's just against Carmichael.
Now, Backblast is not only the name of the novel, but also the name of the operation that burned Quart. We don't want to spoil it for the readers exactly what it was, but when did you have the idea locked down that this is finally what it was that burned Quart?
Very early on, people always ask me if I thought that this book was going to be a series when I wrote the first one. And I answer honestly, and I think more honestly than some authors. It's the one conceit I'll give myself over some authors. I was just happy to get a book published, and I wasn't thinking about books 2, 3, 4, or 5. I remember asking Tom Clancy once when he wrote Red October if he knew that Patriot Games was coming, and he said he had it all lined out. He probably did because that was the way his mind worked, but so many people I talk to now, it seems like everybody knew they had this whole story arc in this series, except for me. I'm not sure. But pretty clearly on, I decided, and as you said, we won't ruin anything. I won't spoil anything. But I decided I wanted Saudi Arabia to be involved. And I also wanted it to be something that is murkier. It's not all a big misunderstanding. It's not all evil people targeting Quart Gentry because they don't like him or because he's outlived his usefulness or all these kind of cliched reasons you see in some of these books. You know, I'm not claiming to have broken any new ground in thrillers, but I wanted it to be this something that when Quart Gentry realizes why they're after him, there is this amazing aha moment where he puts his head in his hands and says, oh my God, it's this. That happened pretty early on. In a general sense, I knew what I wanted it to be about, but it was kind of written on the day, the details of the actual mission.
So going back, did you put any Easter eggs along the way, any clues in the books that some people could go back and read and go, okay, I see?
Yeah. In book one, no. Book one is pretty much a 3-day story about the Gray Man running this gauntlet, trying to save some little girls. Book two, there are some little hints in there because he confronts Zach Hightower. Why is everybody after me? And Hightower gives little tidbits in there insinuating that they're after him for maybe legitimate reasons. It's something that just sort of pops up in there, but not huge Easter eggs. As I said, I want each one of these books to be completely standalone. And I have read novels where the first novel I've read is the author's second or fifth or eighth novel. And I feel like I'm reading a bunch of ads for the other novels because they'll be like, you know, remember that time you and me and Bob, you know, went to the moon and, you know, rescued the family or something like that. And it's like, I need to know less about that, you know, if it's not related to this story, and more about the story that, you know, I bought to read. So I think about that a lot when I'm writing. I want everybody to be able to pick up. As I said, even this book, book five in the series, it answers a bunch of questions that people have had that have read the first four, but you totally pick it up and have never read any. And I've already read reviews that have said the same thing. It's the first book that they've read. I get more reviews now that it's in hardback. You get more professional reviews. And so many of the reviews that I've gotten so far have been from people that have never read anything in the series, and they give a good review. So it's something I consciously thought about, and I'm glad that I did.
There's a mystery writer, Lisa Lutz, and she had a series about a family that did private investigation. Mm-hmm. And it's a comic series. Uh-huh. And she would refer to something that happened in a previous book, and she'd go, now in paperback.
So you feel like that's what's going on there. And I like little teases relative to the story, though you can talk about things that historically have happened. But I read a book very recently where I just felt so lost because I didn't know all the relationships between the characters. And I hope that nobody feels that way about this book.
Is this the first time you've had a dramatis personae at the beginning?
I don't think so.
Because I remember you doing it in the Ryan books, but I couldn't remember in a Gray Man book before.
Yeah, I guess so.
I can't remember.
I kind of remember how they start, but you know, not intentionally.
I almost wish the dramatis personae were at the end of the book, so in case I needed it,
I can go there. But just seeing the names pop up, kind of spoils the story.
Yeah, this has got to be. Yeah, this has to be the first time, because I remember people would ask me, you know, or they would say they liked it in the Clancy books. And I would write them back, and I'd be like, honestly, I put that there for me as I'm writing these big honking Clancy books. And so as I was writing Backblast, I thought, this one does get a little bit deeper. There are more characters in it. So I started to list them out, thinking I would take it out later. And it's about a page and a half of all the different characters that are in Backblast. The Clancy books, I'd have to check, but there's at least two and a half pages, and then more acronyms and stuff like that that I list. So the Gray Man books aren't nearly as weighty as the Clancy books, but I just never took it out because I thought, hey, this will probably help somebody.
Does it feel easier to write the Gray Man books because they're like 250, 300 pages shorter than a Clancy book?
Yes, it's easier for a bunch of reasons. One is that ground level is something that you can write more words in a day because you know that your job today is to write the scene where the character gets to the airport and, you know, follows the guy out, or, you know, there's some sort of an action scene. With the Clancy book, today's the day where you have to figure out why India hasn't used its nuclear weapons against Pakistan. So there's 10 times more reading. And I've always wanted the Gray Man books to be based in the real world, but it doesn't go into the depth of, you're not spending a lot of time with the Chinese Navy or something like that, like you are in the Clancy books. So that takes a lot more work.
So you had a lot of success when you're co-writing with Mr. Clancy, and since his passing, since you've taken over the Jack Ryan series, is there another one coming out later this year?
There is. I, at first, pushed back. They'd asked me to do, which will be my seventh Tom Clancy book. I've done three with Tom and then three since he's passed away. They asked me to do another one, and it took me a while to decide because I didn't have a plot in my head, and I didn't want to just keep going back to the well. I didn't want to write the same book again. We have dealt with a lot of the big real-world problems in the books that I've done. And so I talked to my editor at length. And a lot of it was me going, I don't know if I've got it in me. But there was something that was happening in the world at the time. There's not so much I can talk about because I haven't written the book yet. But there was something that I was like, wow, that's a kernel of something. If I do a little research on it and play with it a little bit, let's see if I can get excited about where we can go with that. And as I dealt into it, I called my editor and just saying, you know, I think this could be a really fun, broad, exciting book. So we did a deal for a seventh one. I don't think I would ever agree to do more than one at a time because I need to have this thing that's going to make me, for the 6 months that I'm writing that, get up in the morning and work all day on it. And I don't know that there's a bottomless pit of those in my brain.
And do you think there's another Court Gentry book in you?
I'm working on it right now, so I can answer that question. And that's a little bit of a spoiler that you know that the Gray Man survives at the end of book six.
I didn't say that.
You asked the question. I'm always honest with you, Stephen. So yeah, I'm writing a book six right now, seventh Clancy, sixth Gray Man book. And having a lot of fun with it. It's going really, really fast, which makes me want to answer some of your questions in different ways because it's like I'm right in the middle of this character that you've mentioned and how they've developed, but we'll just have to wait for the next one for that.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by and sharing Backblast with us.
It's always a lot of fun. Thanks.
Mark Graney is the author of Backblast, which is published by Berkeley. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.